from tragedy to triumph. Hosted by Aaron Lane.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of Tragedy to Triumph. I'm your host, Aaron Lane, a man in long-term recovery who has dreams and aspirations of doing big things. Now, I haven't done one of these episodes in a long time, mainly because of the pandemic. I can't get into a studio, social distancing, the list goes on. The gentleman I have today who we've actually have been talking a lot over the phone over the past couple months. We've tried to do this before, and then there's issues with scheduling and so on and so forth. So I'm glad to finally get this guy on the show to get his story, and then just and what better way to come back and then come back swinging. So with that, my guest today is Jake Evans. Jake, before we get into this amazing story of what you're all about, why don't you give the listeners an idea of who you are?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, in a nutshell, my name is Jacob Evans. I grew up on the East Coast, grew up in West Virginia. If you ask my dad, he would say that we're hillbillies, but I mean, that term is so loosely thrown around, it's hard to tell like who's who and what's what.
Right.
But I grew up in the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia, which is super close to D.C. and Baltimore. And for those of you who don't know, it's literally the very tip of the state. And we're so close to those areas that a lot of people who work in D.C. will live in Martinsburg, which is where I grew up. So my mom is a presidential appointee. She has worked underneath numerous presidents. My dad is a family practitioner dentist. In light and in short, they are completely self-made people.
Right.
So my dad's one of five. My mom's one of four. They put themselves through school. Say that they were poor whenever they were growing up would be an understatement. My mom is of mixed descent. She's half Japanese, half Irish, so in West Virginia.
Yeah.
So, to say that like the odds were stacked against them whenever they were growing up, I would say would be an understatement. And so because they were able to rise to the prominence that they were able to, that put the expectation on myself and my younger sister to be able to do the same because we have a head start.
Right. Like, absolutely.
It's like, so for us to do anything less than stellar our entire childhood was expected. We need to be able to do phenomenally. And so, you know, I've heard, especially nowadays, and you know, we can get into it without getting into it, but there's a lot of talk thrown around about privilege and all these other things that gets thrown out. And I'm not going to be the first to sit here to say that, like, you know, I've never needed anything in my life in terms of like my property, like shelter, food, never needed anything like that. So I can admit where I may have had definitely like a head start.
Okay.
But one thing that I'll say is that in order for me to have that, like my parents were out building careers. And so it wasn't uncommon for us to be the very first kids dropped off of the babysitter, the very last kids picked up. Sometimes not even picked up because, again, like my mom's working in D.C. So, I mean, where you get some things, you also lose some others. And I can say this because so I know I'm kind of going on a little bit of a tangent. But
no, you're good. Go for it.
I'm married to a woman who comes from one of eight. And so growing up, everything it is that I had, she didn't always have. Right. Like they did struggle for shelter. They did struggle to have food. Like they did have those wants and those qualms, but one thing that they always had was each other. And it's interesting because they lost their father, the main breadwinner, whenever she was 14. The mom had her own struggles, so like the kids really like banded together and helped raise each other, and they always had one another. So the one thing that the house was always filled with was love. And not to say that my house wasn't, it's just that like when you're not there and you're not present, it's hard for it to be felt. So in a nutshell, I'm just trying to set the context and set the stage. Had a huge head start in life, but the way that a kid internalizes their worth is that, well, you know, mom and dad aren't here, so right. I must not matter.
Well, and I think
and then that kind of sets the stage for
right.
how everything else unfolded for me.
Well, and I think it's important to sit here for a moment. And you said a couple things, like early when you started getting into, your story here, you talked about your dad would say that you guys are hillbillies, right? And I find that really funny mm-hmm. because then you start going into the areas of what your dad being, you said, a dentist, right? So a family.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. and then your mom, you know, working, in the capacity under several different presidents, like presidents. That doesn't scream, you know, hillbillies at all. And as you're saying that, I'm thinking, okay, so maybe the West Virginia part, but even then, it's right on the tip, right outside of of D.C. So, you know, I think that's an important, or it's funny to me that you bring that up. But you start talking about here, you know, being raised in a household where there the people were high functioning, self-made, and there was a level of expectation that was there. And you can and that was something that either was, you know, said that, you know, you are better than this or you're destined to do big things. Or, you know, was not even, it was just kind of a subconscious thing where this is just what you guys were exposed to. In my own life, you know, I look at, and you talk about privilege and things like that, and that's an important conversation in some areas. In other ways, I feel that it's almost silly, right? There's people in a lot of different circumstances. People can make of themselves, they can do amazing things regardless of the circumstances that brought them there. Is it more difficult for someone that grew up with nothing? Absolutely. So just being able to be given something doesn't guarantee, like, you know, living, you know, having life handed to you on a silver platter or the exposures you had as a teenager or whatever does not necessarily guarantee how you're going to carry that out moving forward. People get out of the ghetto and they make something of themselves. People can be, you know, born in the best of lives and then end up dying early because they partied their minds away. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's so many, I believe there to an extent. I just find sometimes it's like, no, you can, your family could tell you you're worth it, that you can do anything you put your mind to, but if you don't believe it, it doesn't matter. Do you know what I mean?
I agree 100%. Yeah, 100% I get that. One of my favorite statements that I tell to people that are early in recovery, especially when I'm dealing with the family dynamic, is that if love and support could keep you sober, it would have worked a long time
Absolutely.
Ago.
Absolutely.
And I think that works across the board for a lot of things. Like, if love and support could have made you successful, it would have happened a long time ago. I think that you can transfix anything that you want to into that subcategory. The reason why I say the hillbilly thing is because even though we had this degree, and I'm going to use the term affluence very, very, very fluidly.
Right.
So,
I
like, I'm just saying, you know, I'd never grew up in a shack. I always had my own room, so I'm going to use the word affluence. So just because we grew up in a certain amount of affluence, my dad made sure that I knew where the roots of that affluence came from.
Yeah, value of hard work, right?
Yeah, so like my dad grew up every single day after school working inside of the farm, the garden, like doing something laborious each and every day. Now, for me, I was the only kid on my block. Again, like, this is a more affluent area. I'm the only kid on my block with chores. And you're like, oh, chores, yeah. No, like, being given a chainsaw at, like, 10 years old and being said, like, go chop that tree down. being told to, like, you had this huge stack of wood. He's like, I want that stack over here. You move it all over there, and you're halfway through the day. And he's like, you know what? Actually, I didn't like it there. I wanted it back where it was. Going up onto a mountain. So we have a mountain where we set up camp and like it has an outhouse and all this other stuff. So this is where the hillbilly side comes in, like hunting and fishing and, you know, building a cabin with our own hands. Like, so we did all that growing up and we had this outhouse that we had to build. And he goes, Jake, you know what? I want you to dig the hole for the outhouse. And I was like, Dad, it's shale. Right. You can't like dig into this. And he goes, yeah, you can. And he hands me a digging iron and he goes, I need 5 foot by 5 foot. So 3 days go by. I'm digging at this thing and I get it maybe two by two, maybe. And granted, I'm like 10 years old, right? Like 10, 11. Right. And so like, I get it maybe 2x2. He comes up the very last day on a backhoe, does one scoop and gets it all finished. So like, that's the sort of stuff that like I grew up with, right? So like two, 3 days of like working my butt off just for him to come up on the very last day and then just scoop it out anyway, something he could have done on the very first day. The points that he was trying to make is that like nothing is just handed to you. You have to earn everything. When you're going through these tough times, these things that you don't understand why you're doing what you're doing, like you have to know that sometimes there's just a grind to it. And so for me, it's like I look at this and then like it definitely taught me the value of hard work. I never looked back on anything growing up and thinking like, oh, my life was harder because of X or Y. It's just, that's just how I grew up. I didn't know anything else.
No, and I think that's an important point to make. I mean, you know, we can all, if we are all honest with ourselves and reevaluate our life experiences and how we were raised, everybody has some level of, you know, that it's kind of like, you know, you talk about being, you know, an affluent neighborhood and being exposed. Like there's different levels to this. Just because there might have been money in the home doesn't mean that we, as you talked about, that there was love, or, you know, because you had access to things and more opportunity just by the very nature of where you lived, didn't mean that that was, you know, became a part of your life. Like people seem to forget that somebody has always had it worse and somebody's always going to have it better, right? But you can't define yourselves from those things. You have to look at it for what it is at face value. Be grateful for the experiences that you've had in your life. Also understand that there's also traumas involved in this. Everybody experiences trauma as a kid. It's not all perfect. And we always look at someone else's life, or we people tend to, and I've been guilty of it as well, to say, man, if I had been raised like that, I would have been awesome. Well, yeah, if you had all the other things that you currently have, maybe the love that you had in your household, but you don't know how ugly it is in there. You don't know how bad, you know what I mean? And that's something, you know, especially with the conversations today.
And that's the point that I'm trying to make. And if I've done a bad job at it,
no, I think
I'm glad that you're refining it, is because ultimately what I'm trying to communicate is that I look at my wife's life growing up and I look at that and I say, man, if only we had had that. Right, that would have been the difference maker. And I'm sure that she looks at my life and says, man, if only we had had that.
Then it would have been.
It would have been different.
And you're smart enough to see that.
Yeah, and then like, but I know that at the heart of everything, right, it's just how we grew up, and it shaped us into who we are. And her experience and my experience is going to shape our child's experience. And
yeah,
I'm sure
it's a nice...
she's going to look at it and say, if only I had this.
So, right, exactly. It's just going to keep rolling. It's just the human condition, Jake. Like that is, we're always looking for something that we don't have, thinking that's going to fix it somehow. Instead of looking internally, I'm like, how can I react to my circumstances? How can I make a positive impact in my life? That's not an easy thing to do anyway. Regardless if you have access to everything in the world, how you feel internally is going to motivate you ultimately.
I've seen that time and time and time again, especially with the clients that I'm working with, where, you know, I have some that, like you said, have literally been handed everything. Like father's multimillionaire. They've been handed everything, but they still in the inside are like, I just don't feel motivated. Nothing is mine.
Right.
I'm building up his stuff. I'm not building up mine. So again, it's about finding that internal purpose and finding that stuff. And so for me, when I was growing up, it was, I was acting out to try to get their attention, to try to get my parents' attention in some shape, way, or fashion. They were always busy doing their own thing. We definitely always spent the weekends together. I'm not going to like discredit anything about them as parents, but I wanted more. Like I felt like I needed more as a kid, and like that might be my addictive nature. That might be just the way that I internalize things. But I felt like I wanted them more present in my life, so I acted out. Because when I acted out, they would give you the attention.
Even though it's not the best of attention, like, I mean, how my kids do that. I know I'm guilty of it as well. My middle daughter will do something so stupid. And like, well, I mean, but when I take it a step, like when I peel back the layer, it's just maybe she feels like left out. Like her sisters get all the attention. She's brought these things up on other other situations. But like, really, that's the root of it. She has something inside that says, hey, I'm not getting what I need. And
yeah,
you're
like,
doing,
look at me.
Right. Look at me, dad.
Yeah.
Like, what was the most recent thing that I just, so we were making, I'm not going to get it all. Bottom line is she's done so many stupid things like that. That I never thought in my entire life I'd ever have to reprimand someone for, like, why are you rubbing hand sanitizer into the couch? Why did you poop in the bathtub? Like, why out of all things would you, and there's toilets right next to it. It's always stuff like that or causing problems at school or whatever.
Just little things, right?
Yeah, you're like, what is going on?
Well, here's the weird thing, right? So, now, again, like I try my best to like really remain cautious about the way that I choose to articulate the way that I thought whenever I was a kid, because I'm looking at it through a 30-year-old mindset.
Yeah, and how you thought things happened too. Right.
Right. And so like now when you trace it back, it's like I know for a fact like my dad struggled with drinking.
Okay.
And our household shifted dramatically when he stopped drinking alcohol. But before all of that, when he stopped drinking hard liquor, before all of that, there was a lot of chaos that was built up. And the more that I acted out, the more attention I got. But there was also consequences to that attention whenever I got home.
Right.
And again, my dad is a a self-made man. So there's a lot riding on his quote-unquote reputation in a small town. And his number one rule was, don't embarrass me and I won't embarrass you. So you can allow your imagination to run wild with whatever you want. But at the heart of the matter is this. When I was in elementary school, I was acting out because I was bored. Like, West Virginia schools are kind of a little bit, at that time, they were behind other schooling systems. And so, and this is the 90s, so they want to put everybody on Ritalin.
Right.
I'm acting out. I'm getting good stellar grades. They can't figure out what the heck is wrong with me. They figure that I need Ritalin. And my parents are like, yeah, you're not going to do that. We're going to handle it here at home. But, like, nothing was shifting. So my dad would just get – he would drink, and he would get angrier and angrier and angrier. His ideal life was, like, leave it to Beaver, come home, mix a drink. Everybody's going to be happy to see him whenever he gets home. And it just simply wasn't that way.
Right.
And so, you know, resentments are building. Anger is building. And as I get older, the anger is getting taken out on me as a kid. And the spankings turn into more than spankings.
Okay.
Is the only way that I can surmise it. Now, granted, love the man to death, made a huge polar shift whenever he got off of alcohol, hard liquor.
But still, the damage was done.
Exactly. But I'm not gonna critique a man for his shortcomings,
right?
Because I've done the same exact
Correct.
Stuff in terms of, like, damage, wreckage, everything. And I know that I believe I'm different.
Well, think about this for a second, Jake, though. Like, okay, you already said with a 30-year-old mindset looking at those things. But why don't we focus on how it made, when you were a kid, when these things were happening, like your dad, you know, as you said, had a problem with drinking. It was in the house. And at one point in time, he stopped, you know, he was able to stop those things, which is fantastic. But, you know, you know, if you look at it from that mindset, how those things made you feel, I mean, it's an important way to tell a story.
It's terrible. Like, it's terrible because what happened was is that I had to get pulled out of public schooling system because they just simply couldn't handle the way that I thought. And it's not to say that, like, I was smarter than anybody else, or that I was a problem child. It's just I thought differently. So I needed more structure. I needed more things to keep my mind occupied.
Right.
So they put me into private school. And the minute that I get into private school, it's a Catholic school, and so I'm a troublemaker. The very first thing I ask a teacher in religion class is, why does the Bible have quotation marks? And the teacher looks over at me and is like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, quotation marks imply a direct conversation. And you just said that the earliest account of Jesus was written 60 years after his death. Like, why do we have quotation marks?
Which is not a bad question to ask, though. Really?
Well, yeah, So they kicked me out of religion class and told me that I had to write the Old Testament down word for word, but they weren't sure what they were going to do with me after that because you can't be in a Catholic school without religion class.
Correct.
So there was borderline. I was about to get kicked out, and my dad was telling me that he was going to have to ship me off to military school. So at this point, I'm probably around 11, 12 years old, and in my head, like, you know, there's this violence that's ensuing at home. I just can't seem to get anything right. I'm just trying to understand things so then I can wrap my head around them. And I'm being told I'm going to get shipped away. So for me, the way that I internalized that at 11 was that my family would be better off if I wasn't around.
Right.
And that, like, maybe the thing is that maybe the problem isn't the whole system. Maybe the problem is me. And the only way that I know how to deal with that is to eliminate me as a problem. So, you know, not to go too deeply into my psyche at 11, but I thought that it was a good idea to try to take my life at that age. I mean, it does go to show the trauma that can ensue from these things. And yeah, I'm looking at it through a 30-year-old lens, but trust me, the pain and the things that I experienced were very real at that time, to the point where I thought it a good idea to attempt to take my life at 11.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing that people seem to forget, right? And I always preface all of those things. Like, when I've told many stories about how I was raised, how I saw things, my hurt, my pain. Some of it is you know, can be skewed by my own, you know, like, we have this interesting way that our memory works, that we somehow, as time moves forward, what's the truth and what's our, you know, what we've created in our mind, there can be, like, a spectrum there, right? You could have the basic levels of, like, hey, like, my parents got divorced, right? That is a fact. I know that it affected me. I don't forget that. But there's other things that I may have also layered on top of that, because you can't rewind the clock. You can't just have, you know, a video account of what was exactly happening or an argument or any of these things. But we don't, we tend to hold on to the hurts, right? We tend to hold on to things that made an impact, you know, whether positively or negatively. And you're talking at a young age because, dude, look, I mean, we, you, interestingly enough, you and I have a lot in common. One, how we were raised, you know, a bit more access. Parents that, you know, were hard workers. Mine were entrepreneurs, were successful. But I had a, you know, a quote unquote, you could say broken, but a divorced home. So I was going back and forth from my mom's to my dad's, and there was new people in our lives and things were changing. And then you know, being sent to a private school, like I was sent there because I took advantage of my freedoms at a college preparatory public school that caused me to get kicked out of there and sent to, you know, to first a Baptist high school, not even Catholic, Baptist, because they're like, we're going to get you the fundamentals. And I get there. And because my life had already, you know, talk about being a troublemaker or whatever. I mean, I had already, the people that I was around were so sheltered, and there were things that, you know, it was good for me to go there, but at the same time, it caused some other issues too. You talk about religion class. Yeah. I would propose questions that I thought I was thinking through, like, I just break this thing down to me. This doesn't make any sense. Like, what do you mean the playing cards are a tool of the devil? Where does it say that in the Bible? Or, you know, people would say, I couldn't say the word shit, I would get in trouble, but other people could call each other fags. Like, how terrible of a place. And I understood this as a kid, too. You know, a teenager looking at it, like, how is this even justifiable? Like, this is, you guys are using hate words or, you know.
Yeah, it was.
And yet, if I say shit, I'm in trouble.
It's
insane.
It was bizarre growing up. And I look at it now through the lens of, like, when all that stuff was going down, my dad came up, he saw me making the attempt. It wasn't like we went in depth with it. Again, like, this is a self-made 1 out of 5, the oldest out of 5. He considers himself to be a man's man. And he's like, he looked at me, he's like, imagine what this would do to your mother. I never want to see this again.
Right.
We never spoke about it again. Like, it wasn't like, what's going on? Why do you feel like this? What made you do this? Like, I think to this day, with the exception of the people who hear this podcast and have heard maybe one or two others where I brought this story up, no one else knows about this. Like, my mom never knew that it went down, unless she's listening, but it was me and him. It was something that happened that he walked in on. He said, don't ever do this again. I said, okay. And then we moved on from it. And you fast forward, and I looked at it, I was like, okay, so he cares. In some weird, convoluted way that my brain was wired, I was like, he cares about me. He doesn't want me to do this.
Which is even more crazy because he probably, he cared about you before that, but you didn't feel as though he did. And yet now all of a sudden, yeah. And it's kind of messed up, man. I mean, let's just keep it real. Young, to feel like, hey, the world would be better off without me. At that age, and to one, be stopped by the grace of God that your dad sees you. And we don't have to break all those things down. The bottom line is you had a plan to take your own life and it didn't work out. And then it was, would you say it was swept under the rug or just one of those, I'm sure your dad didn't want to repeat it to your mom and then probably
I think it's one of those things where it was just, you know, from his lens looking at me, it's like, dude, like there's like, look at my life and look at the things that I went through. Like, you're like, are you serious? Like, don't do that.
And he was shocked. And that's the other thing. Like, we don't always respond to things how the way that quote unquote we're supposed to, and like break that whole thing down, then have the family get together. Like, people can give a lot of scenarios where they say this would have been the right way to handle something, you know, after it already happened.
World's not Full House.
Correct.
Right? Like, not everybody has Danny Tanner as a dad. Right. Yeah. Like, my, so like
it's actually really funny.
Yeah, it doesn't go that way. So like for me, when that happened, I went back in the next day to class because they were going to be making a decision on whether or not I could continue or not continue in school. And so when I went back, they looked at me and they said, are you going to have any more issues? And I said, no, I won't. I'll do whatever it is that you guys suggest. And then they're like, well, we don't want you in this religion class anymore. So you're going to have to write down the Old Testament word for word, and then based on what the percentage of the books that you get finished, that's going to determine your grade.
Jeez.
I was like, okay.
Okay.
I was like, that's fair.
Because you asked the question. Decide. It's kind of messed up, dude. I'm sure it was more than
West Virginia,
but
number one. Yeah, it's
Bible Belt.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, it's West Virginia, number one. Number two, they're young, impressionable minds that they're trying to mold. And number three, like, if it was that question, if it wasn't that question, it would have been a whole host of others.
Yeah, and they just didn't want you. Like, yeah.
Exactly. So they put me where they believed I needed to be, and then I just progressed along, and then eventually by the time I hit eighth grade, I was allowed back in religion class.
Okay.
But at the end of it, what wound up happening through me doing that is I got a lot of self-reflective time. I started reading a lot because I had to do it in the library. And so I started reading a bunch. And it started, like, I started realizing that, like, there's all these people out there that are so-called Renaissance men, and that's what I want to be. So when I got into high school, it wasn't just, oh, you know, Jake, who played football from the time that he was eight on. And again, like, West Virginia, like, football is, like, a big thing.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just football. I also did show choir. I did jazz band. I played guitar in jazz band. I was an all-state jazz musician. I did academic excellence team. I had a 4.0 average. I wanted to be that guy for everything.
Got it.
And hoping that what would happen and what would ensue is that, like, I would find my worth, I would find my place, I would find my purpose by trying a little bit of everything. And when I was in high school, I was maybe 15 or 16, maybe a little bit younger, and I had my own band, and I was playing local shows with people that were 19, 20, 21, 22. So I'm like this 14, 15-year-old kid that's going and playing with all of these guys, and that music scene that's close to Baltimore, close to D.C., there's a lot of drugs.
Well, that's a universal, right? Most exactly. Music scenes, especially when you're younger, hanging out with older guys who want to party, people, I mean, that's going to, so that became a part of your life. How old were you when you started getting exposed to all that?
I was probably, so I wasn't doing it at 14, but I was exposed to it at 14.
At 14. Okay. This became something you saw, right?
Yeah. Like the cooler guys, the people, the cooler bands, the bands that like had the biggest show outs, like that's what they were doing. And they started inviting me into it. Cause I was good. Like, not to say that like I was like the greatest guitar player at 14, but I was pretty good at 14.
Yeah, and 14, right.
And I had my own band, and I was known for fronting my own band. And like, so they were inviting me into these circles, and I would just like stand around awkwardly, like a little weird 14-year-old kid would around these 18, 19-year-old, you know, other musicians. And, you know, there's only so much that I think, you know, as strong as the resolve that I may have had, there's only so much that I think I could have resisted. So by the time I was 15 years old and I was ready to transcend to a different style of band, I was smoking weed. And then weed turned into alcohol. And then alcohol and weed, just at shows, turned into alcohol and weed every day to get creative.
Right.
And then I'm progressing through high school, and like now I'm known as like the youngest kid. So like I'm like 16 with like seniors and stuff hanging out. And I'm known as the, you know, the freshman, sophomore kid that gets high. Like I'm the stoner. But I'm also the football player. But I'm also the jazz band guy. And the thing is that it's such a tight-knit small community that everybody knows it.
Right, I see what you're saying.
So, like, my dad's best friends know. The school principal knows. Like, everybody knows that, like, I'm smoking weed. They just can't pinpoint me or catch me because I'm doing it with these people that are outside of the school area because I'm connected to this music scene. So, progress forward out of high school, like, I get accepted into dental school. And at 18 years old, I get accepted into dental school. So, that should, like, kind of tell you how the schooling system set up for somebody who thinks the way that I think, or my hard work, whatever you want to chalk it up to. 18 years old, I was accepted into dental school, and I saw my life play out. And basically, I asked myself, like, do I want to be the second version, V2 of my dad? And I was like, hell no.
Right.
I don't want anything to do with
that. And people run into that, right? Like, sometimes, you know, it's a natural fit. Like, my younger brother, Eric, you know, has worked with my dad since he was 14, 15 years old. He's had his own struggles in life, different paths, but ultimately now they're business partners. Like, and he's always wanted to do that. And I think it's awesome, right? You know, on the other end.
Not you.
No. Like, and I think it's cool stuff what they do, but I never wanted to do that. I never, like, I wanted to do something else. And so the same thing in your life, you're like, I don't want to be a damn dentist. Like, you know.
Well, my dad is different, right? Like, my dad was super passionate about what all he did. He said from the time he was young that that's what he was going to do. And I worked and I saw one other dentist who wasn't passionate about it. And I saw the way that he treated people. And I was like, I'm not passionate about this. I'm going to wind up like him, but I'm literally going to have my dad's practice grow up less than, build a house less than a mile from where my parents live. And that's going to be how I grow up. And I don't want that story. I want to have my own journey. And boy, did I get it. I didn't drop out of school the right way. I just stopped going. So I'm somebody who used to have a 4.0 average. Now I'm down to a 0.0 because I just stopped showing up to classes. So needless to say, I got kicked out of school, pursue music full time, get my recording engineering certification. I'm working in a recording studio in Rockville, Maryland. And I'm like hanging out with this recording engineer. And I realize all of a sudden I get another glimpse. And like during this time, I'm doing all kinds of party jokes because my band is touring. I'm in the the underground Baltimore scene. So like I'm exposed to ecstasy, acid, cocaine, like ketamine, like you name it, I tried it. And there was a period of time where I was exclusively doing it and then mixing it with other drugs.
Right.
And I look at this guy who's a recording engineer beside me, and I realize this is like the path that I'm on. And I realize like, you know, this guy looks like he like was literally a cardboard cutout of Wayne's World. He had the acid wash jeans, holes in the pants, long hair, but balding up on top. And I'm like, he literally looks like he got stuck in the 90s. And I looked at myself, granted substances were definitely involved. I walk into a mirror and I look at myself and I'm like, and I just like see myself 15 years in the future, but I'm wearing the same clothes. I'm like dressing the same way. And I'm like, dude, I do not want to be you 15
right.
years from now. And I had a best friend who drummed with me. He was a drummer of my band. I grew up playing guitar to his drums. He grew up playing drums to my guitar. So we were like in sync. And he just like transformed in like 1 year. It was weird. Just like completely different mannerisms, like everything, like in a really positive way. And I was like, college is where people go to grow up. And like, that's not true for everybody. This is, again, substances are involved.
Right.
I'm doing one pass. I'm
but
like,
you,
I need
mostly
to
it is
different.
True, though, right? Mostly it is. If you go to college in those times, in those formidable years and learning things and experiences, yeah, it will tend to make you grow up.
Or at least just get away from your hometown, right?
Right.
Like, to provide context, like I'm still living like within like less than a mile of my parents, but I'm traveling into Rockville all the time. So it's not really, I haven't really like left my hometown. So I'm still like in my hometown mentality. So I decided, I'm like, you know what? I can write music. I can play music. I can record it now. The one thing I can't do is represent myself. So I'm going to go to law school. And again, that should provide context for like how my brain works, is that like, it didn't seem like it was out of the question with a 0.0 GPA that I was going to be able to work my way into law school. So I buckle down, I get it together, I get 4.0s the whole way through, I become student body vice president, I was in student government for a number of years, I become academic chair of a fraternity, I only joined the fraternity to become an academic chair, I am a National Model United Nations delegate, highly decorated, working full-time to put myself through school, and again, like getting a four-year degree in 2.5, almost 3 years. Because I'm doing 19 credit hours a semester.
Unreal, so, dude. You're like the quintessential overachiever when you actually put your mind to it. Just throwing that out there.
I'm just busting my ass because, right. When I see something that I want, I'm going to go for it. But the one thing that I never did was address this addiction thing, right? So, like, in the background the whole time, this thing is bubbling and brewing.
And did you ever, let me ask you a question before you, like, to, explain that a bit more. Did you ever feel, though, that was a catalyst for issues? Like, did you ever suffer any consequences at a younger age with that?
Yeah. So when I was, like I said, a small town, everybody knew that I was getting high and that I was smoking weed, but no one could ever pinpoint me.
Right.
One funny story is that like, I used to skip home. I mean, come on, like we're all on, anybody who's been to high school, we'd skip homeroom. As long as you made it in by second period, they wouldn't make the phone call to your parents that you were absent that day. So I would skip homeroom. There was a kid who lived about a block and a half, maybe 2 blocks away from the high school. And I would walk to his house, and in front of his house was a gas station that sold blunt wraps. And so I would walk to his house, I would go buy the blunt wraps, and I would come back and I would smoke, two or three blunts with him, and then I would go back to school. And I was walking to the gas station, and the vice principal drives by, and she's like, Jake, the homeroom's the opposite way. And it's like 10 minutes until homeroom. I was like, oh, yeah, I know. I'm just getting some Gatorades. I'll be back in. And she goes, okay. And again, like, I'm well-known there. I'm a good football player.
Right.
I'm in jazz. Like, everybody knows who I am. And again, and everybody knows I'm getting high, but they can't catch me. And so I'm like, yeah, I'll be back. And so little did I know that that principal pulled off to the side and watched me walk into this kid's house. We used to play this joke on each other. It was me and another football player and this dude. We used to play this joke on each other where we would go to the store, come back, and we would bang on the door super hard. Our football coach, our head football coach from Martinsburg High School, they're like seven-time state champions or something like that now. But he's a hard man. He was the vice principal of discipline for my school. So we would knock on the door super hard, be like, hey, it's Coach Walker. And like try to freak each other out while we were all high. Well, this one time, while we were all there in the house, we hear this huge knock on the door, and we were expecting like, oh, maybe it's a friend or something like that coming over to mess with us. And my friend looks out the door and he's like, it seriously is Coach Walker. And then like everybody's heart sank. And he's like, I'm not kidding, dude. He's like, it's really Coach Walker. And so I get up and I jet to the back of the room. And I try to get out of the door and like, you have to pull it, can't push it. So I'm trying to push this door up and I knock it off the hinges. I run through the thing, and don't ever let people tell you that white men can't jump, because I was jumping 4.5-foot fences.
Oh, that's
to try
awesome.
To like avoid,
yeah, yeah,
get away, and like, because I can't get caught, right? My dad's number one rule: don't embarrass me, I won't embarrass you.
Right.
So I'm jumping, I'm leaping, but the one thing that I never did is that I didn't cut, right? So I just was running straight, and they're only 4-foot fences. So I hear on this blowhorn, Jake, go ahead and turn around. We already know it's you. And I look down and I realize I'm wearing my football jersey. I have my football number on.
Oh my gosh.
So like I come back and I'm tossing everything out of my pockets and maybe incriminating like a cigarette here, a can of chew there, like whatever it is. I'm like 17, and they come up and they're like, you know, Jake, we know that you've been smoking. We know he says that you've been doing this. I was like, dude, I haven't. Like, the only thing I can tell you is this: I came over here. Did I get high? Yes. I was like, I have nothing on me. You can check me. And so they couldn't get me for anything other than truancy, not being in school when I should have been in school. But that's enough at that age to take you to the police station and try to scare the shit out of you. So they take me there and they're like, who are we going to call? I was like, don't call any of my parents. I was like, just hold me here until you can't hold me anymore and then let me go. And then, like, no, we're calling your dad. So my dad shows up and it just wasn't pretty. I get back into the car and, like, of course, like, yeah, it just wasn't pretty. Just wasn't a pretty
no,
yeah,
well, I mean, because you did before. Something stupid and you're a kid, yeah. and your dad, I mean, you even just said your dad's saying was, don't embarrass me and I won't embarrass you. And that's what parents don't want to have to deal with that. That's just a part of being
yeah.
one. I mean, my parents yeah. did, like, did many situations. Hell, I stole a gun. Dude, there's a situation where some kids stole a gun from our house, and I thought it'd be a good idea to grab another one from there and to get the original gun back. So here I am walking the streets of our neighborhood with a gun in my waistband. My dad, coming home from work, sees me standing on the corner, and he's like, hey, son, what's going on? I'm like, Dad, don't worry about it. I'll be home in a bit. I got this. He didn't even know. He just thought, you know, he had no idea what the hell I was doing. He was just yeah. like, all right, I'll see you at home. And here I am. The moment I walk in the door, I get hit in the face. Like, my dad's like, what is, you know, I had to give him the gun, but it was so bad.
Yeah.
It was so, no, so bad.
We do stupid stuff.
Right.
And so I didn't ever, and here's what's really weird is I remember after that incident, the friend that I was with, I went and picked, my dad told me to go drop my friend back off after. So he got both of us out. He told me to go drop my friend back off at his house. And here's what's interesting about that friend. We're getting really tangential. That friend that I was with, I played football since the time I was 8. But what's really interesting is that we were actually born in the same exact hospital room,
okay.
like less than 6 hours away from each other. So, like, you know, hadn't seen each other for 8 years. All of a sudden, we're playing football together every single day. Now we're getting high together. and so, like, and then we got in trouble together. So, like, this is a friend that, like, my family knows really well. Like, everybody knows we know each other. He's from the other side of 81, which is, like, Martinsburg's equivalent of the other side of the train tracks. And so, anyways, long story short, I'm driving him back, and I'm looking at him. I'm like, dude, we got to stop smoking weed. Like, I, like, have this epiphany. I'm like, it's leading to nothing but bad stuff. Like, we can't keep doing this. And then he's like, yeah, man, you're right. And then he's like, you know, there's nothing good that comes of it. And then I was like, but it is fun. And he goes, yeah, it is. And then I was like, do you want to smoke again? Yeah. So I had this moment where I had this conscious conversation with somebody else that, like, you know, this is bad news. There's yeah. all these consequences, but the fun outweighs the consequences for me. So I always had this like mentality where I could see the foresight, but I never gave it too much merit. Now you fast forward and you're compounding, you know, I can do whatever I set my mind to, that mentality on top of this substance abuse thing. So I'm drinking like crazy. By like crazy, I mean, like, if I have an excuse to drink, I will. I'm not turning my nose up to any substances. I'm doing pretty much everything. But the thing that always tricked me about my disease is that I would have these strings of time, whether it be like, you know, 2 weeks, 2 months, whatever it was, where I would try these substances and then I would have one bad experience. I'd be like, I'm never doing that again. And I never would. So like it happened with ecstasy. I was like, I'm never touching ecstasy again. And I never did.
Right.
It happened with LSD. I was like, you know what? I had one really amazing trip. I don't want to have any more bad ones. This one was good enough. I don't want to have another bad trip. I'm not going to do anything else. And I never did. And like, and I can go down a whole string of substances where I made those decisions and I never touched the substances again.
In a lot of situations, you can do that, right? Like, I mean, hell, I mean, yeah. I always told people, you know, like when I found out I was allergic to, you know, pecans and walnuts, I damn sure have never had one again. Do you know what I mean? Like that's all it took. But I was like, I wish they could have applied to heroin because, you know, even though I had so many bad experiences, why? And I have this, you know, allergy to it. Why wasn't I able to feel the same way? Well,
it's
obviously
weird. It just doesn't register the same. It's strange because like the substances that didn't hit the switch for me were fine. Right. Like it was like, I'm not going to do these. I've had good experiences, bad experiences, but ultimately like I'm done. And I was able to hang up my guns and finish. Now, I went on this National Model United Nations trip, and for people who don't know, basically what that means is we simulate the UN at schools from all over the world. It's really highly competitive. We're talking like the best and brightest minds being pulled together from all over the world. And these are 13-hour days where everybody's like working their butts off, and then you go and you party with other countries and cultures at the end of the night. That's just like what it is. And I'm on the bus ride for this trip, and this kid pulls out these little blue pills, and he starts to smash them up, and he's snorting them, and he like catches me looking at him, and he's like, "You want some?" And I was like, "Yeah, no, dude." I was like, "I'm good. I don't. The only thing I put up my nose is cocaine." And then he goes, "Well, you can actually smoke these." And I was like, "What?" And he goes, "Yeah, you can smoke these."
Oh, great!
"Show me how you smoke them." And so I watched him put a blue pill on a piece of foil and literally hit it with the lighter and chase it down. And I was like, "That looks interesting. Like, let me try it." So I did it. And the minute that it happened, it's like, I like think back to this all the time. The minute that it happened, it was like something switched in my head. And I was like, this is what I've been looking for. It shut everything up. It slowed everything down.
Right.
And it was like, it was like all these feelings of like insecurity, inadequacy, the constant chatter that was going on in my head about, am I good enough? Yes, I'm good enough. I'm going to work my ass off to do all this stuff. Like it stopped and it was silent. And I was like, this is nice. And so went another 4 days of me using these pills on and off the whole time and feeling like my performance was way better. So it was like, because it's slowing things down, I'm thinking clearer, I'm acting better. It's crazy. And I'm on the way back from this trip, and I'm starting to feel like really, really, really sick, and I can't explain it. And like, I'm used to these trips. I've done probably 7 or 8 of them now, and it's different from just being overworked and overtired. I can't explain it. I'm just feeling weird. My stomach feels like it's in knots. I just can't figure out what's going on. And as I'm getting off the bus, the kid goes, "Hey, if you ever want any more of those, all you got to do is call." And I didn't know what he had done at the time, like looking at it. But when I got off the bus, I go and I tell my sister about it, who has an illustrious history with substances. And she goes, "You're withdrawing from opiates."
Wow.
And I was like, "What?" And she goes, "You're addicted to opiates." And I was like, "No." I was like, "It's only been 4 days." She goes, "That's how long it takes." She's like, "Here." She's like, "Show me how you smoke the pills." So now this starts me using with my younger sister. I showed her how I hit the pill, and then instantaneously that feeling was gone. And I was like, "Oh, shoot.
Right.
I can't afford to feel like that ever because I'm student body vice president. I'm working 60 hours. I have law school. Like, there's no way I can feel like that for days on end. Like, I can't. I can't afford it." And so thus started a year and a half of me using every single day.
How did you fund that, by the way?
My schooling was completely and totally free. So if you're student body vice president, And I've been working since I was 14 and saving money.
Got it. So you through, had money. How much do you think you spent?
I had plenty of money.
In that period of time. I mean, if you're doing them every day, if you're smoking Oxys every single day, right?
It was terrible. So I wound up giving up a salaried position so then I could work as a waiter so I could have instantaneous cash every single day. So I had my savings. I wanted instant cash every day. And I was doing at that time maybe 4 pills a day, splitting them with my sister who was also working. Like in total with how much we probably spent, I've talked, now that I have a kid, I look back on it and I'm like, and it's disgusting. The head start I could have given my kid it's just disgusting. I think probably over 200,000 maybe.
Unreal, right? Like when you really break that down in something that doesn't, that is just a chasing a feeling, right? And I always thought, it's interesting. I mean, this whole pandemic has given me an opportunity. Like I've been writing more and, just thinking about it, just for whatever reasons revealed more things to me. But I always go back to that. I'm like, we chase a feeling as opposed to some reality. It's not like, it's the interesting thing about drugs, right? They can enhance or take away, right? They typically we do drugs because they're fun and we like the way they make us feel. They don't do anything other than make you feel different, right? So when you bust down the next day, like you wake up, you know what I mean? Like that, what you just did the night before was just like, you got to do it again. It's to chase this feeling, I want to feel,
it's diminishing returns too.
That's right,
It wound up getting so, I look back on it and I just realized like how messed up it became because it was like, I did it so then I could maintain in between these events. Right. And so as I progress in my disease, things are slowly starting to taper off. So I'm no longer student body vice president cause it's a 1-year term. So now I have a lot more free time. I'm no longer doing National Mall United Nations anymore because I'm in law school full time and I'm getting involved in their extracurricular. So I gain more time. And slowly, the more time I gain, the more I'm getting high and the more I'm focusing on how to get high. And so my disease is just progressing and progressing and progressing. And I always think it's interesting. It's like I tell this story about how I wound up getting sober or realizing that I needed to was I was in this class called cybersecurity. And my mom, her forte is information technology and cybersecurity.
Got it.
I was in this class called cyber law. And I thought it was like, oh, we're persecuting black hat hackers. Like they're like committing cyber crimes. And we're like, that's what this is about. I didn't read the class description. I was so loaded. I forgot to withdraw from the class when I realized what it really was, which was just copyright infringement, online copyright infringement. Nothing I was interested in, but I was so loaded. I forgot to withdraw. So I'm in this class I didn't really want to be in. And I just so happened to be stuck in it for the rest of the semester. And my addiction's at its peak at this point for that fraction of time. And I just get the sticky note on my desk about halfway through the year. And it just says, Jake, we need to talk after class. And like, I didn't know who she was. She didn't know who I was. I've never spoken to her before. I just give her a thumbs up. And she pulls out this sheet of paper at the end of class. And it's just like, tardy, 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 on time. Tardy, 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 tardy. The list goes on and on and on and on and on. And she's like, you're about to fail this class because you can't show up one time and you have the highest grade point. You have the highest test average out of anybody else here. She's like, something's wrong. Something's amiss. Are you okay?
Damn.
And that's all she asked. And I like remember very distinctly me having like a split second. Like, have you ever seen Saved by the Bell? You had to have.
Yeah.
Remember
it's
when
my favorite
would be like,
show ever.
Remember whenever he would say, like, freeze, and then he would, like, talk to the
camera?
Yeah,
he talks to, yeah, he breaks the third wall or fourth wall, whatever they call it.
So, like, I literally felt myself break the fourth wall and, like, talk to myself and say, dude, like, you have a chance right now. If you go this route and you choose path A, you're going to wind up, yeah, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, seize good degrees, you'll be fine, but eventually you're going to have to deal with this shit. And you can become disbarred if they find out what it is exactly that you're using. They're like, or you can just take the olive branch that's being handed to you right now and see what happens if you're just honest with somebody who's trying to help you. And for whatever reason, I was tired of carrying that load. I was tired of being that fake person that I had filled up. Because you want to talk about chasing a feeling. I was chasing everything but what I should have been chasing, which was fulfillment. I thought you know, if I get into law school, I'll be happy. If I become student body vice president, I'll be happy. If I have this, I'll be happy.
Yeah, and money, this, right? No, and that's that, dude. That's a universal thing, right? Like, that's always, you even talked about that at the beginning, right? If I had this, my life would have been different. If my family was more supportive or we had more money, it would have been different. And that's not the reality of the situation. It's just not. Mm-hmm. And even in the context of what you're talking about, and you know, given an opportunity here to really, you I like talking to you because you have this ability to dive deep and articulate these moments in time. And there's a lot of parallels and different, you know, like, obviously I had different life experiences than you have, but knowing in these moments, like to be bold enough to say, yeah, I have a problem, has always been something that was like insanely difficult for me. Like it took,
I think it's for everybody. I mean, I think it is for everybody. And for whatever reason, this woman, I don't know if it was that she was non-threatening. I don't know if it was the way that she said it.
Because she barely knew you or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know what it was, but I think that in that time, I was like, you know what? If she knows, probably a lot of other people know, and I'm probably not hiding it as well as I think I am.
The fact you could articulate that, even see that, right?
Yeah, and so I was like, you know what? Like, I'm just going to tell her. And so I laid it all out. I said everything. This is what's going on with me. And I word vomited for maybe 20 minutes. And I broke down. There was tears. There was fear. Like there was everything. But at the end of it, I felt this huge weight come off my chest. Like, now someone knows. Now what? Right. And I remember that coming out of my mouth. Now what? And she goes, well, now we got to go tell the dean. So I'm like, oh, now someone else has to know. And so I go and I tell the dean. And again, like, you know, I'm nervous, but it all comes out again. And I feel another huge weight come off my chest. And I'm like, and now what? And they're like, well, now you got to tell your parents because we're going to set you up so that then you can leave. But, like, you know, you need to let somebody know that this is what you're struggling with. We can help you find resources. We'll do whatever we need. So my mom comes up for a football game, like, 2 or 3 days later. And I remember grabbing her by the knees. Like, this huge thing happened. It was a big fight between my sister and me because I was going to tell my mom I was addicted. And if I told her I was, and, like, it's pretty obvious that my sister was. And so, like, by me letting the cat out of the bag, I was going to let the cat out of the bag on her, too. But I didn't care at this point. Like, I figured I would wind up saving both of our lives. So I remember grabbing my mom by the knees and, like, looking at her in the face and being like, I am severely addicted to opiates and I can't do it on my own. I need help. And just, like, the utter shock that was in her face. Like, she knew something was up, but opiates, I think, like, really shocked her. And they tried having me go back home. It didn't work. I went to this 30-day program. The very first thing that I did was dismiss everything that I heard because my first roommate was somebody who'd been in and out of treatment 16 different times. And I was like, you know, am I really that bad? Like, this is what my life was like before.
And I know that feeling too. am I really as bad as him? No, I'm not.
Yeah,
the first time I went to treatment, the same damn thing that I experienced. Well, that's the thing. It's such a disillusion. You will be if you continue on the path, right? And I couldn't.
Exactly.
And even being given that information and able to intellectualize it. I was in detox giving my lead. Like, what is wrong with me? Do you know what I mean? Like,
well, here's the really bad thing that was terrible. And if you're somebody who does help out with treatment, or you're somebody who's out there who's you know, who runs a treatment center, runs groups or whatever, and you use this statement, I highly advise against it. I was in my first 30-day treatment center, and they told me to look to my left, look to my right. One of you is going to be dead. The other one's going to be in jail. And most of you will be sitting in the same exact seat again.
Yeah, I hate
hopefully,
that. That's not always.
Yeah, they're like, hopefully you're one of the two people statistically that will make it through this and succeed. And I was so sick at the time that I didn't look. I was just like, I hope I'm not dead. Like, my brain didn't register as I'm one of the two. That's going to be me. It was, I hope I'm not the one who dies.
Man. Yeah, I never like when people do that because it's one.
Yeah, it's terrible because the minute that was said, I was like, well, I'm going to fail anyway. So I'm just buying time.
Exactly. That's the danger of it.
Yeah. And so, like, I'm sitting inside of my one-on-one sessions with my lead therapist, and he's not an addict, and then he's trying to tell me I have to be sober for the rest of my life. So I'm dismissing everything he's saying, and he's like, Jake, you know what? I know you're smarter than I am. He's like, so everything I say, you're just going to pass it up anyway. I was like, no, the reason why I'm passing it up has nothing to do with your intellectual level. It has to do with the fact that you've never done it a single day in your life. So how can you tell me how to do it?
Right.
And so, like, I just dismissed everything because I was that special kind of idiot he thought that he was smarter than everybody else. Right. And like, maybe when it came to taking a standardized test, like maybe I was smarter than a lot of people, but when it came to actually living my life and being happy with it,
it's called actionable intent. Right. Actionable intelligence, right? As I said, you can intellectualize a lot of things and you can debate them and you can, but when it comes to something like this, you can't outthink it. You can't be smarter than it, right? It's something that's well beyond our control. And the only, you know, in order to arrest it, we actually have to ask for help first step. You know, all of these things in regards to the. Oh, it's dude,
it's terrible. And
it's even more tough for people like this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. And within less than, I would say by day 22, I was planning my relapse of my 30-day treatment center. So, like, I was already thinking it out and thinking it through. And I get back home within a day or so, you know, not very long. I'd already drank. I started using again. And I remember having another conscious decision. I'd been using for about 3 days here and there. So 3 consecutive days. And I remember waking up one day and like, and I had extra left over from the day before. Rare. And I remember talking to myself saying, yeah, I know. Right. But remember, I just got out of 30-day treatment. So my tolerance is lower.
Right.
So I got up and I remember saying to myself, I'm not sick. Like really astounded. Like I'm not sick today. I can stop right now because this is the third day, right? So my only experience before, because I was using consecutively, was by day 4, I was severely sick from using. So day 3, I woke up and I'm like, I'm not sick. I can stop right now and never go back to this ever again. And I remember like knowing that there was stuff inside of the drawer. And I was like, if I do this, this is only going to end one of 2 ways. They've already told me. I'm either going to wind up back inside of a some sort of institution or I'm going to be dead. And I remember saying, oh, well, and picked it up and I did it anyway.
Yeah.
So when I made that decision, I think I was actively like trying to like make it way worse. Cause I was like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going all out this time. And my using to say quadrupled is an understatement. Cause I was sharing everything with my sister at one point. So I was using at the peak of my addiction for a 10-day span. I was using 30 pills a day. Which is insane.
Yeah, it really is.
And I still wasn't convinced that I was a full-blown addict. And so when I finally realized that I was on my way back to the treatment center because the cat was out of the bag, and I'm sitting inside of an airplane bathroom waving smoke away from the smoke detector, crouched down, smoking pills off of foil. And I had this conscious thought where I was like, if I get caught right now, it's because I'm in U.S. federal airspace. Like, it's not any one state's jurisdiction. It's 7 years for every single pill I have in my pocket that's not mine. I mean, I'm going to jail for a long time.
Unreal.
And I did it anyway.
Yeah.
And I was like, I have a problem. And that was whenever I decided that I had a problem. And I did all 30 of those pills in about 4 hours from West Virginia to Tennessee, on plane rides from West Virginia to Tennessee. I showed up. I was so loaded, I couldn't sign the paperwork for my admission. I went back to the same 30-day treatment center. I woke up. So I went in on the 12th. Well, actually, it was the 11th, turning the 12th at midnight. And I didn't wake back up consciously, remember writing a date on a piece of paper until the 14th. So that's my sober date.
Unreal.
It's the 14th.
14th and of what? Say this again. 14th
of January.
January 14th. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so, and this was 2 months after I had just left this same facility. And I go back to my same, I request the same exact therapist, and I sit in his office. And he goes, Jake, he's like, not surprised to see you. And I was like, I know, right? And I started laughing, and I was like, listen, I was like, last time I was an asshole. I was like, this time, I don't care what you tell me to do. If it's hop on one foot, pat my head with one hand, rub my stomach with another, and you tell me to do it for 1 hour, I'm going to do it for 2. Because that's how serious I am about getting this right. I don't ever want to see your face again.
Wow.
And then he looked at me like with wide eyes, like the very like, like Scooby-Doo face. And I was like, I don't care what you tell me to do. I'm gonna do it double what you say because I'm never going to see you again. I never want to see your face again. And he goes, you need a long-term treatment. And I was like, look for it. Find me the toughest one you can find. And I got exactly what I asked for. And they found me one called Treehouse. It was set up by a former U.S. Navy SEAL. No medication, so it's not medically assisted treatment. I don't knock medically assisted treatment. It's just I asked for a hard program, and I got what I wanted. And so I went to a program that you didn't do Suboxone maintenance. You didn't do any of this stuff. You worked out. You made big connections with people. And you stuck it out for 5 months. And I remember I had to do a pre-screen on the phone. The guy was going through it, talking to me for about 30 minutes. And he goes, "Do you have any questions?" And my first question was, "When do I get my cell phone?" And he's like, "It's 30 days blackout." And so he's kind of like off taken. He like went through this whole 30-minute spiel talking about how awesome the program was. That was my first question. Just during about another 10-minute spiel, he goes, "Do you have any questions?" I was like, "What about a laptop?" He goes, "You know what, dude? No. We're not doing this." He's like, "You're not serious. When you're ready." He's like, "How many days sober did you have again outside of treatment?" And I was like, "I don't know, like 2 or 3. He goes, "Yeah. When you get 30 days clean outside of a treatment center, maybe then you can tell me what you think you need in order to keep yourself sober. He's like, but when you're serious, you can give me a call back." And he hung up the phone on me. Click.
Yeah.
And I remember calling my mom and I was like, "Mom, he said I don't need that program. He said that I'm good to go." And she goes, "Really?" I was like, "No, not really." And I could tell she was like scared in her voice. Like, "What the hell? Like, this guy really said that to you?" I was like, "He's the only guy who's ever called me out on my shit," which is honestly true. He was. You got to remember, I was 18. I was accepted into dental school. I said I wanted to become a lawyer and I wanted to get into law school. I worked my butt off and made it happen. Anything I ever said I wanted, I got because I was willing to work for it. I come up to this thing and I'm told I'm not a good enough at it. So that registers for me in my head. I'm like, dude, yeah, right. Not only am I going to get into your program, I'm going to take your job.
Right.
And I'm going to be the best client you've ever had. And so I called him back the very next day. I was like, "What do I got to do to show up?" He's like, "If you're serious," he's like, just get a plane ticket, show up here and interview with the team." And I was like, "Done." Hung up the phone, showed up out there, worked my butt off for 5 months. It was an amazing program. I loved it. Within 2 months of graduating the program, they asked me to take his job. Granted, he got promoted, but the job became vacant.
That's hilarious. It really is funny.
Yeah, I know. And it's like, and I wind up doing that. I didn't know if it was going to be a long-term thing because, you know, I have this law school thing that I'm still working towards. But I started doing it, and I started realizing how important and vital that role was for me whenever I was in, you know, that person's shoes. And that was over 4 years ago now. And I remember going back to my law school and telling my teachers, because like the time was coming up, I went and I sought that teacher out. This is right before my granddad passed away. My granddad was like more of a like father to me than what my dad was. So he got diagnosed with cancer. I went back to go see him. And I went back to this law school and I found that teacher. I told her, I was like, "This is what I'm doing. I'm working for this treatment center. This is what it does. I'm helping people get into this treatment center. I'm helping them seek better lives for themselves." And I was like, "And I want to come back to law school next year." She goes, "Wait, what?" She's like, "Jake, you just told me that you're helping people do all this stuff. You're so passionate about it. Why do you want to come back to law school?" I was like, "Well, because I started." And she goes, "That's not a good enough reason."
Right.
She's like, "If you come back here, you need to make sure that you're passionate about it." She's like the same passion that you have for helping others. She's like, "Otherwise," she's like, "I think that's your purpose." And I didn't know it at the time, but I went and I talked to my granddad and he like kind of gave me his seal of approval. He was like, "Jake, if you never come back here, i.e. to West Virginia, to Martinsburg, he's like, I'd be happy so long as you're happy and you're helping other people." And that was the last sober conversation I had with him. Meaning sober, meaning that like he was on all kinds of meds to treat his stuff after this. And like, he just wasn't the same man post this conversation. And it was like, I got that seal of approval. So I came back here. This beautiful woman was working across the street from me at the time. And I was like, I kind of had this like new gusto, like, yeah, I'm going to do this thing right. And so like, I started actively pursuing her, you know, fast forward. She's my wife now and mother of my child. You know, she inspired me to become even better than what I was already doing. She's like, you could help people on so much more of a personal level than just getting them from point A to point B. She's like, you should become a recovery coach. So like I started doing all of that. I created my own company called Hope Guides. I've been helping people from all across the country, like things like this. Like before I got onto this, there was a guy from Florida who had heard something just like this. You said, your story, I relate to. I run my own company. I have all this stuff going on, but I just can't seem to sift through the minutia of my own thinking.
Right.
I feel like you're the only person who can help. And if I was just representing a treatment center, and just being on the other end on the phone for a treatment center, he would have never heard my story. This guy may never have received help.
Mm.
Because, like, I wasn't the guy that was under the bridge. right? I wasn't the guy that was in and out of jail, but I was creating some wreckage, and I was actively destroying my life. I was actively killing myself.
And that's all that matters in that.
Yeah. And it's like, and it's, my story is as bad as it ever gets. Right. And like, say that like other stories that are worse than mine stop happening, because people can start catching these glimmers, these signs
early, right,
before it ever happens. Right. Cause I was on the path, dude. Like, I definitely was.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, and you know, and thankfully you didn't, because let me tell you something. Someone like yourself would not bode well in jail. It's not, I mean, you just wouldn't,
right?
Because this is what tends to happen, because I've run into it a lot of times myself. The way I speak, you know, when I can articulate things, people take it as disrespect, because a lot of times in jail, because they don't always understand it. You get a lot of that.
Yeah.
You know, then you have to see the injustices right in front of you, be a part of that being thrown at you. I mean, it adds this layer, it hardens you up, and not in a way that would ever be, I don't think, is ever beneficial. You see how much hopelessness there is there and all these, it's just like it adds another layer, and then being disconnected from family, all these things. You know, like, as I said, I've never lived under a bridge either, right? I didn't, was not a Skid Row bum, but it was more than bad enough for me. And if you can be what they even talk about in, you know, some AA literature, being like a high bottom drunk, you know what I mean? To say, like, you don't have to lose everything in your life in order to turn it around. You can say, this is more than enough pain for me to switch. And thankfully, you were able to see those things for whatever reason, even though you it wasn't like the first time you realized that you just figured it out. You had an epiphany that required some work. And then when you realize that you have to do whatever it takes in order to turn this around, then in that point, you know what I mean? Like, you can.
It's so bizarre. I think that in some shape, way, or form, we all have those moments. It's just how much are we paying attention post those moments, right? We all have those moments where we're sick as a dog, not knowing how we're going to get the next fix that we need, and like, and knowing we're going to have to do some things that we're really going to regret in order to do it, doing some things that we're really not proud of. Like, we all know those moments and what I'm talking about, and maybe you're going through one right now, and you're curled up, you're sick, you can barely move. You're crawling to the toilet, and you, for me, it was a prayer, right? Because that's what I grew up with. That's what I knew. And so I remember actively saying, like, anything you give me, I will do. Like, please just, like, get me through this. Like, help me out. Like, do something for me. And if I am really being honest with myself, every time I said that prayer, the teacher came about. The treatment center happened.
Right.
The second treatment center happened. The call from that guy happened. Like, every time I gave one of those, and they call them Foxville prayers, you know, in the rooms, but every time I gave one of those, I got an answer. It just, was I paying attention? Was I willing to accept it? And
yeah.
Like, and for me in those moments, I was like, dude, like, I've tried it my way. I've done it my way. And my way just leads to more and more and more pain. Like, you know, can I be successful? Yes. Can I be happy? Obviously not.
Right.
Like, something else needs to be factoring into this, to what I call fulfillment. And like, for me and countless people in AA, what they know that fulfillment comes from is from helping other people who are in your situation.
It absolutely
does. And so when
does.
You can be, yeah, when you can find that fulfillment, happiness comes around a lot more frequently and sticks around a lot longer. It's like, I can actually enjoy the things that I have now because I feel fulfilled at the end of the night.
Right. And I think, and there's a lot of truth to that, because it's been evident in my own life. And obviously, you know, we were even talking about before we opened this up, like, you know, I had a crazy, like, this morning, my wallet's gone, everything's stolen out of there. But ultimately, I'm like, I'm not, you tend not to, like, worry about those things, because ultimately, in the scheme of life, my life's really fantastic, because it's a focus on service of others.
Here's the awesome thing, too, right? You're not the guy taking the wallet.
That's the, exactly. I'm not the guy, dude,
$50. I'm not the guy who needs that wallet.
I was
shocked,
though.
I'm not the guy who needs the wallet anymore.
Right. And I knew for a fact, when I saw there was a $50 charge at, White Castle in the middle of the night, I'm like, he has to be a drunk. Has to. Who else is going to spend $50 at White Castle at 3 a.m.? I get it. So, you know.
So it's like, I look at those things. That's how I look at it, too. And it's like, you know, I hear these parents that call in because, you know, I did the math the other day, Aaron, and I've told you this a handful of times, but it's over 5,000 conversations that I've had with people who are in the early stages of recovery, whether that be a family member or an individual, over 5,000. I'm averaging over 1,000 a year.
Unreal.
Yeah, it's crazy. I'm coming up on 6 years sobriety. And then I'm coming up on 5 years working this job. And so having done and over coming up on 2 years of coaching. So like, whether it be through like Treehouse mediums, whether it be through, the rooms, whether it be through my coaching practice, I'm having these conversations day in and day out. And when I'm having them, I'm like talking to these people who, you know, the parents are like, you know, he just doesn't see that he needs the help yet. And so I get on the phone with him and I'm like, okay, so how old are you? And I'm 33 years old. Okay. And I'm just throwing out a number. I'm 33 years old. Okay. So you're 33. Where are you living? Well, I'm living here. What are you doing for work? I'm doing this. What is your family life look like? Are you married? Do you have any kids? This, and this. Okay. Now I want you to go back 5 years. Are you where you thought you would be 5 years ago? And like, well, no. I was like, okay, how did that look different 5 years ago? Where did you want to be? Like, well, I wanted to be here, and here. Let's say that we just removed alcohol and drugs from the situation. How much more time do you think you would have? And then they laugh normally, and they say hours a day. I would have back hours a day just thinking about it, doing it, trying to get it. I would have hours a day back. What if you took those hours that you had and you applied it towards getting that life that you wanted 5 years ago? How much closer do you think you'd be in 1 year? And then I get them to stop and I'm like, you give me 1 year, I'll get you that close to that lifestyle that you want.
Right.
And if drugs and alcohol even play 50% of a role in that, like, you're doing yourself a disservice by continuing to do it. And normally that's enough of pulling somebody from the emotional side to the logical side of their brain to sit back and realize this dude's right. Like, I need to at least give it a shot.
Yeah, you got nothing to lose. That's the thing, right, man. Like, you get to the point in this, and that's why I think it's so beautiful to be in a situation where we can help other people, right? A conversation, a family member, all of these things. You really break it down. Like, you guys, you know, well, it's this and that. And I understand the concerns and worries because my family's experienced them. I have experienced them. The list goes on. But ultimately, you have more to gain by doing this now than you would have to potentially lose. Right? It doesn't work out. I mean, I always tell me, like, okay, so it doesn't work out. It can and will. We're like, he's been to treatment 10 times before. Like, so this can be the last time. Let's make sure it's the last time. Say, I believe in people. You know, you talked about early on being in treatment. Like, two of you, you look around, look to your left, look to your right. That person's not going to make it. The other person's going to jail. Like, screw all that. That is not a way to approach this. You got to look at it and say, today's the day. Today's the day for you. Today's a day for your family to get their son back or daughter back, be a good dad. All of those things can happen now. You just got to be, you know, just got to put that one foot forward and say, I'm willing to do whatever it takes. Because it doesn't matter what type of level that you're born into or, you know, a family that has access to things or you talking about, you know, privilege. None of those things matter. Love doesn't matter. While these are all great catalysts, these are, you know, to have, you know, more, you know, money to do this or do that. Ultimately, it comes down to the individual. Like, what are you? Are you as an individual willing to do something? Because none of all this other shit matters.
Agree. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. And it's like, ultimately, no matter what, it wasn't the insurance that I had. It wasn't the check that was being written. It wasn't the therapist, any one particular therapist. Treehouse is a phenomenal program. I'll never knock it. I got way far. I know for a fact I was way healthier than most people who have 6 months sobriety just because of the work that I put in.
Right.
Like I had to be. Right. I'm doing 68 hours of treatment a day. A lot of it is working hard, like working out 10 times a week and like, you know, building myself up. And like, so of course I'm healthier physically, mentally, emotionally. Of course I'm healthier. But my mindset was strong from day one. From January 14th, I walked into that thing and I said, I don't care what you tell me to do, I'm gonna do it.
Right. And I'm doing twice. I love it.
Yeah. And I'm like, and so my mindset was strong from day one, right? Because I was just tired. And like, people say, oh, are you sick and tired of being sick and tired and all that? The cliches are cliches for a reason. It's because they're normally true.
Right. Like, I'm tired of actually feeling like this because I've felt like this before and nothing happened and nothing gives and all this other stuff. Like, all right. I mean, I've tried it my way a bunch of different times, different configurations, and none of it. It brought me to this moment. So I am willing.
You just got to realize, like, here's my favorite analogy that I ever heard from anybody is this. If you're working a constant math problem, right? And you keep coming up to the same result, and the only variable that never changes is you, then you got to change yourself.
Right.
If you're that only variable that's consistent throughout all the wreckage, all the negative instances, then like you're part of the issue.
Right.
And so like for me, I just remember it so very, very, very plainly. It was, I'm giving up, and not giving up in the way of like how I did whenever I was 11. I'm giving up trying to figure this thing out, because this is something that I use all the time. Like, and you're somebody who went to Baptist school, so you'll understand this. How long did Moses travel in the desert for?
I forget.
40 years.
Yeah. 40 long years. Time, everybody.
He and his people stumbled around the desert for 40 years. Now, if you liken recovery to a desert, right? And you say that, what are the odds of you getting through that desert yourself, not knowing where water is, not knowing the path to take, not knowing what's a mirage or what isn't a mirage? What are the odds of you being able to successfully navigate that desert?
Right. Very low. Right.
Probably not very high. Like some people will make it. Right.
Right. Correct.
Right. But like it could take you 40 years.
No doubt.
Right. And so like, and I know people who have done it their own way, and it did take them a long time to figure it out. But what I will say is this, is that if you type in the same exact path, right, if you say Egypt to Jerusalem, and you type it in right now into your computer, and you put it on foot for Google Maps, how long do you think it says that it takes for you to travel that?
Wow. I have no idea, though. I'm guessing
seven
you...
days.
Seven days?
Days.
1 week.
A week. So, like, the point is, why do you think it takes less time? Because somebody took the time to go through,
and find out the
exact course.
I've used these analogies before, too. Usually I say, you know what, like, imagine that we have to get somewhere. There's a buried treasure, okay? And I'm saying, hey, it's in the woods somewhere. And then someone says, I have a map, right? I know exactly where it is.
Yeah.
Would you rather use a map that someone has already laid down the path of how to get to it? Or are you going to try to make your own map to get there? Are you going to try and figure
exactly.
it out? And that's honorable. Like if you want to spend, think about how much longer that would take. You start really, and it's the same analogy through and through. And like this idea of like, if I'm not the problem, there is no solution. These things are, whether they're cliche or not, it's the reality. People have already taken the guesswork out of this for us, right? People,
exactly.
Think about how much, and I had that thought early in my recovery, that, you know, almost 4 years ago, right? I remember sitting, I was doing something, and you know, you got these treatment paperwork. Hazelden has released so much information, like all of these different things, all these papers and relapse prevention plans and all this, and people think they're stupid. I'm like, imagine what it was like before any of this existed. Before anybody took the time to say, oh, this is a catalyst, this could cause you to relapse, all of these things, identifying triggers, cravings, all of that silly stuff is actually there because people know now what others go through and what could potentially cause you to not have a life of recovery. So I want to use those things, make my life easier, use the knowledge of a group of people that have been clean and sober for 10, 15 years, or even just a day longer than I have. What did you do today? You know, some of the things I had to develop on my own, whether it's doing this show or, you know, helping people in my community, one of the biggest things that has ever encouraged me is just working with somebody that's in the, trying to have a life of recovery. That's been the one catalyst, is helping out other people, you know, and sharing my experience in order to keep it going. Because it's like the more I help, the more I'm helped in return. And I've said this many times on this show, the more I help, the more I can help others, which in turn allows me to... It helps me more so I can help more people. Like, it's this giant circle of what recovery looks like. And it's worked in my life. It's worked in the lives of other people. You know, I do sending positive vibes, whatever that stuff is. You know, like if you just call someone or something. Yeah.
And Aaron, and you think about it, it's like I sat here and I told the story of two separate people who had very instrumental roles in my recovery. The guy who hung up the phone on me and the woman who called me out.
Right.
And she herself, like that teacher herself, struggled with substance abuse, right? So she struggled with it herself. Hers was more mental health and alcohol, but she suffered with it herself, and that's how she could identify it. That's why she felt the courage to say it to me.
And by the grace of God, so like, you got that. I'm listening.
Exactly, right? And so those two people right? And like there are others, of course. Like there's countless people who come into our last route of recovery who keep us one more day.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we all have endless stories.
Right.
But those two people were huge catalysts. And think about how many people you're the catalyst for and how many people I'm the catalyst for. And if you're listening, if you get sober, how many people you can be the catalyst for.
Right.
And that's why it's a never ending cycle. Mm-hmm. And that's why that's the beauty behind it. And like, that's what gets me excited about it is like, you know, if I can help Johnny get sober, how many people can Johnny help?
Yeah. And that helps fix it.
Will touch.
Correct. I agree. 1,000% on that because I've even had a conversation with one of my good friends the other day. I'm like, imagine, cause you know, we had a high string of overdose deaths this past week, like 25, mm-hmm. like 10 days. It was really bad. And I thought to myself, like, you know, he and I both, you know, used IV heroin, fentanyl, all of those things. Like, we're still here, but there would have been, let's imagine for a moment that we are not, okay, you lost your life, Daniel. And here I am talking to him, like all the amazing things that you've done since you got sober outside of like, you know, your family, think about all the people you've positively impacted. That would have never happened. It would never, and same thing with me. I would have never done any of these things and this idea, you know, and I don't focus my life in saying I'm a hope shot for other people. I just know it's important to share that recovery works and that, you know, if you're willing, I'm going to help show you different ways to go about it. I don't have all the answers. Yeah. That's why I have a show is to listen to other people and how do they do it so that someone can listen and say, you know what, I like that. Aaron, he does, you know, I get what he does. I just don't know if I could do it like that. So how about how Jake does it? So,
yeah. Or you know, and even if not you or I, they reach out to you or I, and then they tell us what's going on with them. And I'm like, you know who you would really connect with? This person.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of networking. That's the beauty of everybody just trying to help each other out one day at a time.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, cliches, but the reason why they're there is because they work and because they're true. And like, in the longer that you have in recovery, the more that you know it. And you know, I've been inside of rooms with people that have like 26 years clean and their whole entire share, like, and these men stagnates, their whole share was nothing but a string of cliches.
Oh yeah.
And I'm like, and I'm like, but you know what? They have 26 years clean.
So it must be doing something.
Right. And it's like their whole share was nothing but a string of cliches. I stayed sober one day at a time and it wasn't any one thing. It was everything. And it was like, it's going through and their whole share was nothing but a whole string of cliches, their whole 26 year birthday share.
That's
and
I'm great. Like,
and I'm sitting there thinking to myself with like 40 some days clean. I'm like,
yeah,
you know what? Like everything you're saying is a cliche,
right?
But maybe I should internalize it. Maybe I should say these things to myself. Like when time gets hard, one day at a time.
Yeah.
And sometimes it
works
minutes,
if you work it. Right. God is or he isn't. Maybe, you know, all
yeah,
those
sometimes
things.
It's like sometimes maybe I just need to say that stuff to myself. It's like a little mantra to get me one step closer, even if it's a half inch or a full step. Right. And it's like I look at these things and I realize over the course of my life that, you know, I love what you said. I don't have all the answers.
No.
Right? But I know a lot of people who know a lot of answers. Right.
Right. You know, enough people, you can get the common knowledge there. So it's
and it's like, and it may not be me and it may not be you. Right. But it's like, I know a lot of people. Right. And if you join this community, not to make it sound like some cult, but like if you take the plunge and you just try, like, trust me, whenever I say I love the map analogy, like the treasure is yours. Like we want to hand you the map. We have a million different ways to get to the treasure. Right. Like we've all been trying to think of thousands of ways to get to the same goal, which ultimately is just fulfillment, peace, like not having that internal.
God, that's worth everything, dude.
That's going on all the time.
You know, and
like, and we've thought of a million different ways to go there. Just pick up your map and start walking it.
I always think to myself, like the peace alone is worth the price of admission, right? I feel on a day. And for the most part, some days are really tough. Like even this morning, like I keep going back because it's recent. Like even in my stuff being gone, I look at it and it's like laughable to me. You know, I don't really worry about it. Like I have my concerns, like I got to get a new ID. I'm getting on a plane in a couple of days, all of these things. But ultimately, I look at life in such a different viewpoint now. Like something that would have easily set me off. Or I was like, shit, I don't have a debit card to go get money out so I can go buy dope. You know, whatever that was, I don't have that same thing. And for not, you know, if we've been through that and you understand like what my life used to revolve around or yours or other people's, that's a huge win to say it doesn't matter. Yeah. This is not going to cause me to throw everything away because ultimately I know this will pass and I'll get back to feeling feeling better than I was. So, Jake, let me ask you something, like, because we can close this out a bit. Like, I always, you've broken down a lot of different things, and I really appreciate you taking the time to dive into that. And we've, you know, and analyze and you know, look through these things on your 30, you know, as a 30-year-old's perspective. If you could say something to someone who is still struggling, what would that be?
I would say the number one thing is this, that that really helps me, is that I looked at where my life was, and I decided where I wanted to go. And for instance, the way that you have to look at it is like this. For me, this is what really helps me. Is when I was sick and I was struggling, I saw where I was and I saw where I was heading. I tried to look 10 feet in front. And I asked myself, like, where do I want to end up? And I for me, myself, I call this a China analogy, but you can transfix anything you want to call it, the Florida analogy or the California analogy, whatever you want. Where do I want to end up? And then set that mark as a destination. And if you stand up right now and you say, okay, I'm going to quarter turn to the left, I'm going to half turn to the left, and I'm going to full turn to the left, and you walk out 10 paces. Well, if you walk out 10 paces from any three of those turns, you're going to wind up in three very different locations.
Right.
Now transfix 10 miles on top of that. Now transfix 20 miles on top of that, you're going to wind up in some very different locations. And if I'm trying to get to China, I don't want to wind up in Berlin, right? Right. And so ask yourself, like, if I want to get to China, what do I have to do in order to get there, and start reverse engineering it? And I guarantee you the number one thing that's going to pop up is just got to get clean.
Right. Good
stuff.
That's
number one. And so if you want to get to China, like, do yourself a favor and start reverse engineering those goals and realize that, like, number one, the very first thing is getting clean and reach out to somebody who can actually help you. And it doesn't have to be me. It doesn't have to be Aaron. It can be anyone. Don't necessarily do what I did and seek the world's number one best information giver, which is Google, because there's a lot of questions out there. And Aaron, I know that you know this too. There's a lot of places out there, some better than others, right? And ultimately, like, we're all suffering with this thing. And unfortunately, some people try to take advantage of people who are suffering through this affliction.
It's sad, man.
It is bad.
And you know what? It is what it is, though. We have that everywhere.
I wouldn't seek Google is all I'm saying. I would reach out to a friend who you know who got it right somehow or another, whether that's you, Aaron, whether that's me, whether that's someone who you relate with that you can connect to, and then ask them questions and ask them if they're willing to help you ask the right questions so you can find a place that's good for you. Because Triage was great for me. It's not going to be great for everyone else. Right. I know people who've gone to indigenous male detoxes. I know people who have gone through hospitals. I know people who've just gone through structured livings. But ultimately, it's about finding the thing that's going to be best for you based on your particular circumstances and finding somebody who's willing to give you the time to figure out what that is.
Well, I'll tell you this.
So you can get to China.
Jake, if someone wanted to get a hold of you, how would they do that?
So you can call me 304-839-5448. You can go to my website. That's HopeGuides, HopeGuides.com. Or you can email me, Jacob, JACOB, period E, so like end of a sentence E, as an echo, at HopeGuides.com. And I'm more than willing to talk to anybody. Like I just said, somebody had, I seen a video that I did almost a year ago that was on something similar and reached out to me. So, I mean, I'm always willing to talk to somebody, try to help you figure out what you need to do in order to get the next step rolling, because I know that that's ultimately what it took for me. It's just one conversation.
Right.
And so it started the pathway.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to make sure and put that in the show notes. That way people can see that. But dude, I really appreciate you taking the time this morning. As I said, I know it's been a lot of back and forth for a while. We finally got a chance to do it. I'm glad we did this first episode since the pandemic is lifted and people are getting back to work. I couldn't have asked for a better guest. And I think it's really cool, man, when you start breaking down all of these sayings, all of this different things. One thing that you kept reminding, like that you said, was just be not only willing to do whatever it takes, but working twice as hard in order to do it. Like in your mind, just go for it.
I was willing to work twice as hard to get
high. What I'm saying. That's what I mean. Like you would be willing to do anything. And I think that's the key in all of this. Like just be as willing to put the energy you put into that into a life of recovery. So Jake, you rock, dude. Go enjoy time with your family. Everybody else, all of our listeners, thank you for your patience on getting this new episode. I'm starting to get it to where we can do one episode a week, but this is the first one in a long time. Make sure and check out our Facebook page. And that's it. Do big things.
Awesome.